Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. And I am Tom Mills, wearing a bucket hat today, sporting the new white and green Cookie Jar bucket hat.
Is this a vodcast now, is it?
You can get them. And we have Sam Williams.
Greetings, Thomas. Fine headwear, I will add.
Thank you. And Sir Bruce Fitzpatrick.
Greetings, both. Feeling a bit out of practice here, actually. It's been a while since the three of us have locked horns or, you know, chewed the fat.
I think the last time we had a mic in your hand, Bruce, was down in the clubhouse at Royal Cinque Ports.
Yes, with Mr. Craven.
Just nodding away at Paul Craven.
Yeah, what fun that was.
Possible contender for one of my favourite pods that of the year.
Yeah, I wasn't there. Yeah. What a guy. What an interesting bloke.
Yeah, it was it was awesome. Yeah, it was really good fun that. Yeah, but you're right, Bruce. It's been ages since we caught up, hasn't it? Paul's a really good one because I think I mentioned in the pod, I met him back in January and I think I'd been in his company for about half an hour and I was like, I've got this guy in my crosshairs. He's just going to be an outstanding podcast guest. Because he's just one of life's great storytellers. No. I mean, you can just tell, can't you? He's a wonderful orator. But that feels like a lifetime ago. And I think, through the mania of the last few weeks, we haven't actually had a chance to properly catch up as a three yet.
A debrief.
A whole bunch of stuff has happened since then, for sure. I mean, the reason we were down there, which we say during the podcast, the reason we were down there was for the spring meeting. And we've released, kind of really low-key, released a film about the spring meeting. But we haven't had a chance to really talk about the spring meeting. We've been on trips since. It's been pretty bonkers. It's been a pretty crazy few weeks, isn't it? And we've had Bruce's birthday. Happy birthday, Brucey.
Happy birthday, Bruce. 27 years of age.
27 years of age, yeah. Time's marching on. As they
say. Three loops of nine.
Yeah.
Didn't that put you on the spot? Your favourite all-time three loops of nine?
Oh, that is putting me on the spot, isn't it?
I think you came back to me, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, okay, yeah, but I want to clarify this. Have they got to be from the same course? Have they got to be consecutive?
Yeah, I want your favourite. No. I just want your favourite three loops of nine.
If there's only three loops of nine, it could only be like St. George's Hill.
So I could say 27 holes. So I could say five out on the old course and four back or something like that. If I wanted to.
Well, yeah, if you wanted to make it more complicated, it needs to be. But yes, what would you do, five out and four?
Well,
back?
Actually, I'd say I don't think that is necessarily more complicated. That's maybe more reasonable because who's going to go and play the front nine of the old course and then
he already
just
wants
walk
a fight.
On?
Okay, so I'll give
he
you front. So fight. One of them is five out and four back on the old.
Well, actually, I like that, but it's maybe not the best loop.
Which one you give me? Well, you gave me one from Blackwell. Was it the front
Blackwell.
Or back?
Yeah, Blackwell. I'd take
the outside loop of Blackwell.
The outside, leaves 10 holes, isn't it? So yeah.
No,
is
it's
where,
nine.
It's 10.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
I think it's 10 or maybe 11, actually.
10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 5,
no, 4. You've got to play the 4. 4, yeah, 5, yeah,
5,
oh,
8, 9.
He's coming undone here, isn't he?
No, 8, 9. You don't play 6 and 7 because they're inside.
Okay. We're getting distracted.
Anyway,
so, Bruce, front or back nine at Blackwell?
I think I'd say the back nine at Blackwell.
Okay. And your third nine is?
The suspense is killing me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, I'd say the back nine at Blackwell, the back nine at Rye.
Okay.
Yeah. And front nine at Muirfield.
Okay.
I was going to say, I'm astounded if ASEC doesn't make it in there. Muirfield Golf Club. Of course, Muirfield's just been on the TV this week as well. Very verdant.
So we've got it. 27 years of age. Congratulations, Bruce. Welcome to another year of age.
another year on this planet.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are we doing anyway, gentlemen? I feel like it's a long intro of catching up, but how are we doing?
Feeling like I'm just recovering, actually, from the latest stint, although I was a week after you guys, I followed in your footsteps, up in East Lothian, playing a bit of golf up there. You guys had a pretty heavy tour as well, but I think we've probably got to wind back to, you know, moments after the Paul Craven pod concluded, back to the spring meeting, really, haven't we, to, if we're going to do a full dissection and get to grips with how we're all doing since then. I mean, that was probably the last time we played a bit of golf together, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was good. That was, well, you played golf, Bruce. I just kind of walked around and took videos and took pictures and drank Pimm's and got unnecessarily sauced for a couple of days. I mean, that was a pickle. But it was good. We had a really good time. We had people down at Prince's. We played better ball down at Prince's, and then we played some foursomes at Royal St. George's, 36 holes of foursomes with some lunch, and that was quite special, actually, to do the whole thing down there. That Kent coast is absolutely marvelous, isn't it? So you can't really go wrong down there. And
it's mental, isn't it, when you see all three of those clubs in such close proximity.
We must mention George Donoghue on Monday.
Absolutely. I mean, Royal St. Port's on the Monday. What a little intro that was to it. So playing them all in succession. Do you know what? I would be remiss not to say how incredibly fortunate we are getting to host an event at those at Prince's and George's and spend time at all three of those clubs. They are absolutely, every single one of them is magnificent. Do you know what absolutely stands out to me, though, which is, I think, is totally different to anywhere else in England, is the way those three clubs collaborate. They all swim in their own lanes. They all are completely different flavor of experience, you know, from Deal, Prince's, George's, they all feel completely differently. But yet, as a package, it's almost greater than the sum of its parts. You know, the way they kind of manage across the three sites, you know, whether it's with their visitor days or their four ball days, it's just a brilliant example of why clubs that are on each other's doorstep don't need to be in competition with each other and how they work well together. Unreal. I mean, the 28 guys we had down there, I think, all had a blast.
And girls.
And with that, yeah, absolutely. Sorry, guys was a collective term for humans. But I think more events in the offing, for sure. And they are genuinely the most rewarding experience. Every time we do one of these things, I come away buzzing.
Yeah, I think a further shout out as well to just to add on to that is that it's, speaking with Ron McGurk, it's clear how much work is going on at Prince's and how much they've done to the course. But not only that, they were able to quite easily put all of us up in the Dormy. And that Dormy is just such an outrageously good base for the whole of that Kent coast, because it sits on the corner of Prince's and Royal St. George's. And that road then just takes you to Deal in like 5 minutes. So that if anybody's going down to the Kent coast and has got any ambitions to play golf at all, you need to get in touch with Prince's, because their Dormy is quite exceptional and has a manned bar, which is quite brilliant, really. So yeah, we had a great time, and unnecessarily fireworks as well.
And crucially as well, a key benefit of staying at the Prince's Lodge is that you don't have to pay when you use the toll road coming out of the golf club, do you?
Yeah, of course. Going in, actually, you just say,
I'm just staying at Prince's, so you can save yourself a few pounds here and there, can't you?
What is quite bizarre with that is I can't see any actual reason why you would use that weird little toll road unless you were going to a golf club, because unless you're driving to someone's house, and I'm guessing at that point you're exempt from a toll charge as well. There's literally no point. They're paying these people to man
just
the private road.
Work,
I think it's to stop odd, people using the beach, isn't it? To stop people just driving down to that beach.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
or maybe just cutting through from Sandwich to Deal through that, through those back roads, which are just so poorly equipped for, you know, modern day traffic usage or traffic kind of habits, I guess.
Enormous digression here, chaps.
Huge,
this is
huge.
This is what we did. Come on, this is literally
we're going to a traffic podcast.
Just quickly, we should just round off the spring meeting as well. I think a couple of things. One, I think the fireworks is worth a special mention. We just needlessly sent an entire cake of fireworks up into the sky at midnight.
We could have taken two less people and be net neutral. But no, we just thought we'd spend it on fireworks. It seemed like a daft idea at the time.
Totally,
I think
it was excessive, wasn't it? Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. And you guys didn't even have to go and light the thing either. So, you know, you can count yourselves lucky there. I mean, remarkable, actually, what sort of display you can get out of a fairly heavy cardboard box that's, what, you know, 8 foot by 3 foot wide, that he's just sort of parked there in one of the sandy waste areas, and Tom just says to me, I don't know,
here's a lighter, you got 7 seconds.
Just make sure you get out of the way, Bruce. And yeah, you've really not got that long. And it wasn't 7 seconds, it was about 3.5. So even there was some VAT added on. And actually, you know, in the back of my mind, well, what made it, there were two things. One, you said you need to light it the right way around, because if the first one fails, you'll have to light the backup one. So that's something that really isn't, you know, making you feel immediately comfortable that you might have to try and light the backup one. And then actually the initial one that you thought hadn't caught light was working fine, and it takes your head off. And then also the lighter that I was given just wasn't working well when the temperature had dropped a little bit. It was dark. There was a little bit of a breeze, and it was so, I mean, I can't say I use lighters all that often, but it was so abrasive on the thumb. I was progressively taking layers off my thumb, just trying to get this thing to catch and not being able to do it. All in all, quite a seat of the pants stuff really, but you know, we got away unscathed.
This is all life skill stuff for you, Bruce. It's all about building life skills for you. But that was, I think if anyone haven't seen the video, we did put a video on YouTube. It's very self-indulgent, but it's just basically a load of ball strikers striking balls and fireworks. It's pretty much it,
just really. Want to round it off with a little bit about George's as well. What a place. I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it?
I think
my second hit of George's, actually, second time I've played there, really grew on me second time round. Do you know what was amazing as well, as the lunch and spending time in the clubhouse? Mm. Now, that was totally counter to my previous understanding of George's. So, and when we were down there chatting to Rob, the assistant secretary down there, he was like, yeah, we are allowing groups to come in and do the lunch experience at George's and play 36 holes. You know, if there's groups of people that want to do it, he's like, you know, we get emails from them all the time and they talk about it. And which is totally different to maybe the visitor experience that I've always heard about there, which I thought was really neat.
It's just a case of sending an email, isn't it? It's a case, you're not going to get it on golf breaks for sure. But, you know, if you send an email and approach it in the right way and say, you know, I'd like to play some foursomes, I'd like to get the true George's member experience and do the foursomes and do the lunch. And it's all, they were very, very hospitable with that. And also, I mean, I've got to be honest, like I've talked quite openly on this podcast about, I've never been one, I don't like to have expectations going in places. And I was giddy going to play Royal St. George's. I managed to play it the day before the event because I knew that I wasn't going to get a chance to play it at the event. And I was giddy, like playing it. And it's one of the few courses I've ever experienced that's fully lived up to it and probably exceeded my expectations. I thought it was, I was absolutely blown away.
And it was a nice little afternoon after lunch. Me and Bruce went out and played a little exhibition match as well.
I knew this is going to get a mention. This is why I love the course.
Do you know
it's
what?
Just really,
you know,
blowing me away, isn't it? Yeah. What a place. And the lunch as well. It's just all teeing up for the Sam Williams special.
Well, that was what everyone wants to hear about, don't they? We haven't had a proper dissection, but that was a great little afternoon battle we had. Sadly, I fear my golf might have peaked that afternoon for 2022, which with club championships around the corner. Anyway, gentlemen. And then obviously I jetted off to the bit in Ireland. We'll do a podcast on that as well down the line. And me and Tom were in East Lothian, obviously followed by yourself, Bruce, a few days later. So
East Lothian's good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously spent a huge amount of time up there, but playing all those three courses at Gullen in succession, I think two things. One, second courses, because I wrote a blog piece about that last week. Be quite interested to get people's thoughts on it. But also two, Bruce, when you were up there, whether you saw much of the kind of the international travellers that are back, you know, obviously last 2 years, we haven't seen much of that. We've had loads of messages regarding pace of play, all that kind of stuff going on, I guess. Penny, for your thoughts, gentlemen.
I think I'll start with you, Bruce. I don't actually know your itinerary. So what did you play when you were in East Lothian?
Gullen 1.
That was it?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. I played a bit of golf over in St Andrews. And then moved over to play Gullen 1 before driving south again. So I granted didn't spend as much time in East Lothian as you guys, but I mean, yeah.
How is it looking in five?
I think
in terms traveling. Of travelers and visitors and...
Oh, it's busy. Yeah, you really get the sense of it now that it is really busy. I mean, the old course, just looking out across there, I think Boss had like two golf days there or something during the week I was there. Yeah. So big corporate offering with Alex Pettifer, You remember the guy who, what did he do? He played Alex Ryder or something. I don't even know why I'm mentioning that. That's clearly just a throwback to some to some children's fiction book that I read. What was it? Yeah, yeah. That then got made into a film. I can't believe I pulled that out on a podcast. But yeah, him and
he's been on the Limitless pills. Just things are coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, and then a few other models who I don't really know particularly keen golfers were playing in this big Boss Golf day, and then. You know, either side of that, there are a huge number of American tourists and just international tourists generally playing the old course, which is understandable. I mean, I believe that closes for play on the 19th of June.
I was going to ask this, Bruce. This is a huge digression. Are they going to close a lot of the courses up there? And are they on mats at the moment on the old?
Can't say for sure about mats on the old. I imagine they would be in certain areas. They'll have the usual, just from previous experience, they rope off sections of the fairway where balls tend to gather in the months leading up to it. And it looked like, you know, the same kind of rules applied there at the moment. And then from the 19th of June, the old course, I think, is shut. I think it's the 19th of June. Don't quote me on that. The other courses will probably remain open for play for most of that time. Although, you know, there's stands that start to go up. So there's been a massive like hospitality, like three decker hospitality tent has been put up on the right of the 14th of the old, which is the second fairway of the Eden. So that's now been shortened to like a par three. So it starts to like affect the links more and more.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I guess from maybe 10 days, certainly the week of the championship, but probably 10 days or so before, all the courses around there will shut down because, you know, more infrastructure they need to bring in. Obviously, the old course being the out and back configuration that it is, you need spectators to get around those, you know, the new course will take you, you know, down the outward stretcher holes on the old. So the spectators will be walking over that, and then the Eden will get you kind of around the inward loop. So, yeah, I mean, it does really take over, which I think is probably why from like later this month, 2-4 weeks before the Open, the tourism in Scotland, I imagine will probably drop quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll go to other areas, I guess, Ayrshire and Highlands and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So certainly what I've heard from friends caddying up at King's Barnes, for example, like, you know, the week of the Open itself will be really, really busy, and now is a really, really busy time. But the 3-4 weeks before the Open, when the old course is shut, they're, you know, they expect naturally things to quieten down as the tourism just kind of drops in reaction to the Open. So
excitement is building, isn't it? I mean, it's getting really exciting now. You just sense there's been a huge amount of stuff thrown at this 150th, and it's going to be so cool. One thing that does come up is that, I mean, obviously we're lucky enough to be going this year.
Yeah.
Cookie jar media credentials. I've heard St Andrews is actually not the greatest viewing course. That would add up. You know, it's generally pretty flat, isn't it? You look at somewhere like Birkdale, you've got the dunes that you can kind of get on top to watch it. Any sort of insider tips for anyone going for the first time, Bruce? Obviously, you've probably been around there for a couple of opens. Where's the best kind of vantage point?
Oh, tricky one. Yeah, I think, as you say, it's a real contrast to Sandwich of last year, for example, not just because there's going to be far more people there. That was obviously a COVID sort of test event last year, so it was slightly reduced capacity. But as you say, I mean, the landforms are totally different in that because it's an out and back loop, it's very hard to get down the middle of the course. And so you can't, you know, if someone, I guess the good thing is they're the best players in the world. So by and large, this doesn't always hold true, but by and large, you know, the consensus with the old course is if you play up the right-hand side, you tend to get better angles in to a lot of the pins. So if they're binning it the whole way left, you won't have a great view, but then, you know, they're probably not that playing that well. So why would you want to watch those people anyway? So yeah, flanking the right sides of the fairways down the new course, if you want to watch the outward loop and on the Eden, for the inward loop, I think this kind of stretch around 7 and 11 and 12 tee is really, really good. So 7th green, 11th green and 12th tee, there's a stand up there where you can kind of watch a bit of the action from. And just, you know, some really interesting pins. And you know, different ways of playing some of those holes too. So I think that'd be a great spot. And I just think, you know, with it being the 150th and St Andrews as well, it's just the atmosphere is the most captivating thing about this Open Championship, I think.
Connect.
You know, it's just such a brilliant place to be, to soak up the buzz. And I think so many players want to go and really embrace that atmosphere. So, I mean, I remember when I was there for the first time as a kid, I was probably 10 years old in 2005, I think it was. And, you know, seeing like players out walking the street and going and getting a bite to eat at some of the restaurants or wandering along the scores or whatever. It is such a beautiful town and such an easy place to get around. It would be cool if we saw more of that, which I'm sure we will.
I think for me, it's going to be a really strange one because, like, as I've been mentioned on the pod loads of times, for those listeners that are fairly fresh to the podcast, I started golf quite late. I was 28. I've only really been into it for, you know, 8 years really when I started. And I don't think I've ever paid attention to an Open at St Andrews. I mean, the last one being 2015, I probably was 2 years into it. I wasn't mad into it then, you know, just kind of a little bit into it. And I don't think I've ever paid a huge amount of attention to an Open at St Andrews. And it's going to be now, having experienced all, you know, experienced playing it and the history of it and delved into the history of the Open Championship itself and the town. And I am absolutely buzzing to see this, to see this event. And I mean, it's going to be a fascinating one. Like, we're going to be up there. If any of our listeners are going to be up there, please do get in touch, because I think we're going to try and run a couple of events and things while we're up there. So please do get in touch. But yeah, I'm absolutely buzzing. I can't wait to get on this. But again, we've done a huge digression. We're supposed to be talking about golf. And
we are going to come back to this. But, you know, there's a genuine chance I need to be in three different places that week. So at the moment, I'm looping in the qualifiers for someone. Yeah. So there's an outside chance. There's a genuine outside chance that I could be looping at the Open. We've obviously got plenty of golf to watch out on the course. But you mentioned the scores, Bruce, which is obviously the road tucked behind the first tee and the 18th green. And as I alluded to in the last podcast, our friends over at Sound of Golf have actually got that hotel for the Open week. And there'll be all sorts of really cool stuff happening there. So, you know, kind of the after party, the miss the cut party on a Friday, evening barbecues, brunches, lunches, you name it. We're going to be doing some live Q&A on stage, all sorts of cool stuff. So when that stuff gets released, make sure you're signed up to our newsletter. Make sure you're on the Sounder newsletter. You'll be the first to know then when those tickets go on sale. So, but yeah, no, it's going to be a blast. We've kind of skipped through East Lothian there, but I would definitely encourage people to jump back and read that blog post from last week. And yeah, and
we also did a pod about Dunbar where we talked about our East Lothian experience anyway. So
yeah, but the blog post was more me, wasn't it, really? So
yeah.
It's not even a joke. He means it.
There was a true word said in jest.
Anyway, before we get there, we're getting to cut our teeth this Friday on another professional event of a slightly different flavour. Maybe not quite the same provenance as the Open Championship, but I think it will be particularly exciting just to see this whole thing play out. It's almost become like a swear word, hasn't it, in the game, this LIV Golf series. And watching this play out for the last few weeks has been fascinating. There's loads of other people covering this too. Incredible level of detail, which I think is fair to say why we've hung back on, you know, kind of needing to do too much on the podcast about it. But yeah, I suppose, what are your guys' takes on the field and kind of what we're in for on Friday?
I think the irony of it is the funny part as well, as you say, LIV Golf and the whole PGA Tour hashtag that they've been, you know, drumming away at for, I don't know if they still are now, was LIV under par, wasn't it? So there's just a nice sort of, yeah, poetic justice.
I think
not,
I've
not
got,
quite the case, but yeah.
I think I've got, all right, hear me out. I think I've got mixed feelings on this one, because golf isn't the first thing that's ever accepted Saudi money by any stretch. You think about Formula One, that's got this massive new track that they're going to Saudi and doing that. I mean, you think about Newcastle United, have got a Saudi Arabian owner, and the Aramco earlier this year, we had the ladies event in Saudi. Like, this isn't a new thing, and I'm not condoning where the money's come from, or I'm not even going into whether, you know, whether it's right or wrong. But it seems to me, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that a load of people that are talking about this, they talk about, you know, where the money's come from, whether it's right or wrong, but then almost in the same breath, they're talking about the PGA Tour. And the two things don't go hand in hand. Like, if you've got a stance against where the money's come from, that's absolutely fine. But it's nothing to do with the PGA Tour. I kind of feel like a lot of people are saying it because they've got an agenda, which is to support the PGA Tour. And it's kind of like, there's no way anything could come and compete against the PGA Tour. And I think if you want to say, I'm absolutely not standing for this because it's, I don't stand for whatever they believe in, that fine, get it. But in the same breath, you can't talk about the PGA Tour, in my opinion.
Yeah, it feels like building a narrative to load the guns against the LIV Golf Series.
I think so.
I mean, what's quite strange is the way they've constructed the field, though, isn't it? When you look at the... I mean, I think, you know, maybe some commentators in America might say it's a particularly weak field. I think it's definitely a more international field. Granted, some of the guys playing this weekend wouldn't be teeing it up with Dustin Johnson week in, week out. So I get it. But by and large, most of those players are accepting some fairly significant appearance fees. There must have been so much work. I would just love to have an insight into a day of how they've pieced together that field. Like, how on earth do the conversations go? Because we've always talked about this before. Like, you know, Tom, would you go and play the 18th hole at Blackwell, play it wearing a pair of budgie smugglers? And you'd be like, no. Well, what if I paid you £2 billion to do it? Be like, well, yeah, I probably would do it then. Okay, so we've established you've got a price now, DJ. At what point does that then get you there? What's the lowest price I can get you down to? That feels like how they've almost built that, the argument to bring, whether it's DJ in or, you know, whoever, you know?
But I mean, you
Mickelson,
see
yeah. half an hour ago, what are we at? Purported to be 200 million, is it, Bruce?
I think there's a few different things, as you were touching on there, Tom, that really need to be passed out in this discussion, because you go on golf Twitter and it just seems like such a confused, hysterical...
Hysterical is a great word. It is hysterical.
Maybe that's just Twitter generally. I don't know. And yeah, if we're going to look at the criticisms of this new venture, I think, as you say, there's notion of taking Saudi money and money, you know, from a regime that, to put it mildly, hasn't got a particularly glowing human rights record or even just a particularly kind of forward-thinking political system that any of us or any people who are engaged in Western golf really would want to be a part of or be seen to endorse. And then there's the second thread, which is the notion of just playing for astronomical sums of money generally, whether that's from coming from the Saudi backed fund, the public investment fund, or whether it's just from, you know, a far more respectable source of wealth that's still, you know, huge sums of money nonetheless. And I think those threads kind of get confused quite often. And as you say, Tom, I think the argument about the morality of endorsing anything that has the Saudi state attached to it is a kind of questionable argument to make, I think, given that there's a lot of double standards out there. Having said that, you could say, well, just because it happens elsewhere doesn't mean we need to endorse it in this instance. But I think the more interesting argument is the kind of notion of, like, what is someone's price and how palatable is it when you see professionals playing for just astronomical sums of money? And clearly, you know, in Kevin Na, he's obviously been the first person to come out and say, look, I'm resigning my membership of the PGA Tour. DJ and a lot of the others, or those who are PGA Tour members, haven't gone that far, but you've got to assume that they are willing to give up their PGA Tour membership because they find the allure of $20 million purposes and $20 million purses and massive signing on fees to be worth the, you know, worth that sacrifice. And I think that's a discussion that is interesting and kind of worth having, because there's such a different, as you were saying there, Sam, there's such a different mix of players who are teeing it up at Centurion on Thursday from the really well-established guys like Dustin Johnson, who you'd think, if there's anyone out there in the professional game who can afford to, you know, go to that kind of trite saying, you know, I don't play for money, I play for trophies. DJ would be one of the few guys who could probably say that, and yet clearly he's been swayed. But then you've also got the amateurs who are just starting out, the Andy Ogletrees and James Pyatts, who haven't had the smooth ascent to the top of the game like Andy Ogletree and Colin Morikawa, and they're probably thinking, well, I could actually secure like my financial future, my family's financial future here if I take this money. So I don't know. I think that's the more interesting side of the debate.
Can an amateur take cash?
Andy Ogletree is professional now. Yeah, the 16-year-old lad, I think, is actually still amateur status, isn't he? No, I don't think he can win under the amateur ruling. So I'm guessing.
But can he be? Pro. I know you can't win, but can you be? Can you get? You can win,
just can't get prize. Yeah, you just can't win money, can you? So, but my guess is that there will be a turn into professional in advance of the event or something like that.
I got a theoretical question for you. If like DJ's gone now, Phil's over there, and it suddenly becomes some sort of rip-roaring success, and everyone says, yeah, okay, I'm in now, you know, I won 125 million, and every top 50 player in the world goes across to this. Do you think the mainstream media that have been so vehemently against this will suddenly just turn coat and say, well, okay, well, that's where all the good players
are.
It's
a fickle thing, isn't it? It's a fickle thing. I mean, certainly players aren't all going to be able to go and take 150. That money is there to incentivize the first person over the line. So, you know, DJ, you know, arguably
the purses are still massive.
They're the first ones to stick their head above the parapet and say, well, yeah, I'm in. And that, I think you know, what they're taking is essentially danger money, isn't it? Because there's so much unknown. We should definitely add a bit of context here. It's Monday evening. It's 9:15. We're recording this podcast. You know, the news about Phil is pretty much only just broken, but I would suspect there's many more chapters before we get to the first tee shot on Thursday afternoon. I don't think they've actually in breach of any regulations or bylaws on this stuff until they strike a ball at that point. Yeah. I think when they hit that shot at 2:15 on Thursday, that's where you might start to see even further stuff come down. So Lord knows what's going to happen with it. There's all of this stuff, and look, it's ground extremely well covered. Mixed field, huge amounts of money thrown at people. It's very easy for us to sit here today and say that they're playing now for astronomical sums of money. If we were sat doing this podcast in 1997 and then looking at where the purses are going to go quite soon, granted, the Tiger boom brought a lot of investment into the game and therefore with it the purses. But by contrast, those purses, you know, almost overnight became astronomical again, didn't they? So it's always relevant to what your current benchmark is, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? I don't think they're playing for an inconsequential sum of money on the PGA Tour week in, week out. I mean, what did Billy Horschel win last night? I've got no idea.
It would have been circa 7 million, I would have thought. No, the purse would have been circa
million. North of that, I think, for Jax, it'd be a $10 million purse, that I would have thought. But yeah, it'd be interesting. And, you know, can the sport really start to resign players like Dustin Johnson and some of these greats from playing major championship golf?
Well, that's the key question, I think, really, because, you know, to bring together the you know, points that you guys were making there in terms of when does this potentially become a mainstream tour, and, you know, how do you get around the fact that surely it's not a bottomless pit where they can keep paying every top 10 or top 20 player in the world, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it will get to the point where, or it could get to the point where you get a strong enough field that the strength of field argument can't be ignored. The world ranking points can't be ignored. They're clearly, you know, then on the table. And those guys who are, let's say, less concerned about money, but more maybe motivated by pride, winning trophies, wanting to win at the highest levels of the game against the best players in the world, will then kind of be forced to come over because, you know, they can, why would they want to be left doing the honorable thing in quotation marks if they're not playing against the best players in the world for the most sort of lucrative trophies? And lucrative is the wrong word, because I don't think they're as motivated by it as the likes of maybe DJ is. I mean, I think he is the story here, because that's a guy who has won huge amounts of money. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, he won the inaugural, well, not the inaugural, but the first time the FedEx Cup had a significant boost in prize money to 15 million. I think he won that. And maybe the warning signs were there when 2 days after he picked up that $15 million bonus for winning the FedEx Cup, he's rolled out the perfect putt out ad on his Instagram page, just hustling for a bit more sponsorship endorsements. So maybe Ryan's always been on the wall, but he's the interesting one because, you know, without wanting to make too big an assumption, I don't think he needs, is it a life-changing amount of cash?
I get that, but I think it is in its personal right, isn't it? I think it's really easy to sit there and think players that win, you know, $20-30 million, that's a decent season for DJ, right? $20-30 million in a season. I think it's unreasonable for us to sit there and go,
I think that's extraordinary that amount.
Yeah, that's a really good day. It's a really decent season. But
Tiger's career earnings. Did you see this tweet? Tiger's career earnings $123 million, and DJ's picking up more. Yeah, DJ's picking up more for this thing than Tiger's earning his career.
It's not for one event. Like he's going to be enrolled for a period of time with that series and stuff. But what I'm saying is, it's really easy to sit here and say, well, you know, he's all right for money. He doesn't need it. It's an altogether different question when you're in the shoes with thinking, well, actually, this puts me into a different stratosphere overnight, doesn't it, in terms of wealth? And I think that argument just falls down fundamentally because everything is relevant. We're talking about elite wealth players, about going to another stratosphere of wealth. I can't really put myself in their shoes and understand that. But, you know, to an extent, that these guys are, if you want to hunt trophies and trophies your only goal, go and dominate the mid-am scene. Go and be Stuart Hagerstad. But the fact of the matter is, these guys are making some serious dosh playing professional golf. So, you know, first and foremost, they're professionals generating a living for themselves. So, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. I do think some of the younger players that have taken it feels like, I don't know whether it's a bit of a panic sort of move to think, well, oh, I've got a long career. Maybe I've got some time to work around it if this thing goes horribly wrong. But at the same rate, I can sort of offset some maybe poor performance or a bit of lack of faith in my game, perhaps. I don't know if there's any truth in that. I mean, last place this weekend is going to walk home with 120K in a 48-man field.
Yeah, and they've probably already been paid a minimum of $2 million to appear there, you'd imagine. Yeah.
I think it's very easy for the Twitterverse to judge anybody for taking 125 million when there isn't somebody sat there saying to that particular person, here's 125 million.
Yeah, exactly.
How are your morals now?
that's what I'm
DJ's
saying.
It's 150, like,
it's really easy for me to say, well, that's bad. I would have never taken it. You know, I can't honestly look myself in the mirror and say, I'm just being really honest. We're all human here, aren't we? Like, let's cut the guy some slack for a minute.
Let's pivot slightly. Let's think about the things that perhaps. So we're going to go and see what it's all about.
Sorry. Can I just jump in for one final comment there, though? If I may, because I think the point you raised there, Sam, the obvious rebuttal to that is, well, you've got to presume that several other players were offered similar amounts of money to DJ and obviously didn't feel confident enough or didn't feel like it was worth doing to jump in. So he is the odd one out here. Like, I know we can say there's a lot of world-class players there in, you know, Louis Oosthuizen, Kevin Na is
they're
right
not the same
as well.
Draw as DJ.
They're not the same draw as DJ, double major champion. And I mean, something that's not really been talked about, the fact that he's fallen out of the world top 10 for the first time in years probably has something to do with the kind of turmoil here that he's gone through. And it probably has played on his mind to a certain degree. But clearly the likes of McIlroy, I imagine Rahm, Koepka, Spieth have been offered similar amounts of money to DJ and said, well, no, thank you. I'm content with my lot. So he stands out for having accepted it.
But like Sam says, it's definitely first mover advantage. I mean, DJ might be looking at it and thinking, you know, I could hold out, but if Rahm goes first and then somebody else goes and then somebody else goes and I'm like fifth along the line, I'm going to only be getting like X amount of money. And that's
50,
you know,
rather than 150.
It doesn't make his decision wrong. The point I'm trying to make is that these guys are human like anyone else. Now, it might not seem at the time that you need to go from flying net jets to having your own jet, But that is probably partly how the mentality works. It generates a significant amount more money. Maybe there's intentions of doing more with that through foundations. Maybe it sets the family up better. I don't know the guy's finances, but you know, he's a lot better off now. It's clearly a draw. Let's be honest. So I think, you know, well, of course. Yeah. So I don't know. I just on that. So obviously we're going to be attending it on Friday.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm quite interested to see is how the actual product works. Now product, quote unquote, horrible term.
You've been working in gold media for far too long, mate.
Yeah. So you've really been around this industry as long as I have been, man. But the product, at the moment, it's going to be streamed, I think, through Liv's Facebook, YouTube feeds. I think there's some stuff going on in America, maybe through SPN, perhaps. But I'm actually interested in how it works on the ground, because there's a promise of, you know, live music. It's going to be, you know, if the marketing is right around this, it's going to feel very differently, which, you know, seems like a big promise. The shotgun start stuff, that in and of itself feels like a totally different way of playing the course. I mean, just imagine playing the players on a shotgun start and starting on 17. You know, it's just not ideal, is it? How does that work?
The benefit of that, though, is that with the exception of a handful of these players, I'm looking at the players now, none of them will have seen this course before. They don't know how it's meant to play in terms of 1 to 18. They're not mentally preparing for that. There's just like, turn up and whack, isn't it?
No chance. Sorry, that's ridiculous. That can't be right. Richard Bland is teeing up this weekend with a potential chance of winning $4 million. He is not turning up and whacking it, I can assure you. So
turn up and whack, isn't
I'm
it?
All for
hit and giggle.
I'm all for flippancy on this podcast, but we've got to draw a line at some point.
Yeah.
I mean they will be having practice rounds. They will be studying it. Like, be under no illusions. The guys turning up there want to win $4 million.
Yeah, I mean, there's some guys here that are barely ranked, and you're just like, the prospect here of you walking away, I mean, with as you say, 4 or 5 million, pretty outrageous. But I think the other element to the shotgun start, which is going to be interesting how it plays out, is obviously, you know, we'll have a good idea of, there will be leaders, obviously kind of leaders heading into the third and final round. But yeah, with it being a small field, it's not unfathomable to think someone could stage a massive final round, come from behind and go out and shoot, you know, something in the low 60s and potentially leapfrog, you know, a lot of players ahead of them. And in that scenario, you could have someone who's finishing on 18, who's, you know, been out in the final group and has not won, and someone's finishing on, I don't know, the 8th, and they're the ultimate winner. And I think that could just be a bit jarring to sort of see how does that work out. You know, there's no that sense of, like, you know, the rules around the course and where
there's
everything
no finality
is.
Necessarily is there be, when you've got the last couple of groups. It
I'm not
be
saying
strange.
Good or bad, but I think it would just be a weird one to get your head around. See how that plays out.
So I'm you know, all of that stuff, I am actually quite interested in seeing how it works. Look, it's not short of headlines. I mean, if nothing else, they've certainly dominated some column inches with this stuff, haven't they? So,
but I think that, I mean, I know we've gone on about this, and I know it's heavy, and I know it's still, but I actually think in lots of ways the PGA Tour are doing the marketing for them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just everyone's, I hate the Liv, and everybody, all these people are talking about how they can't stand Liv and all this stuff, and all that Greg Norman's got to do is just sit back and lap it up because everyone's doing it for him.
Yeah. I can only imagine how many people they've got working on trying to secure these players, though. Like, just being in one of those phone conversations would be fascinating. Yeah. I would absolutely love to be just stuck on the other end of the line, just listening to some of that. Yeah, look, it's going to be interesting. I think the field is, you know, crazy, but I don't think we expected anything less, did we? Let's be honest.
And of course, we're going to have the opportunity to be there. So we're hoping, with a bit of luck and a fair wind, we're hoping to be able to podcast from Centurion on Friday. So we're going to take the mics down and get a bit of work, get a bit of podding done down there. So hopefully we'll be able to give our take from the ground, which should be something that is new for us. So looking forward to seeing what's all about. And I think it is going to be interesting to see something innovative in terms of a shotgun start and everything they've got going on, and seeing how that plays out. And yeah, it's going to be interesting.
the live music element and this kind of different, I understand there's much greater media obligations as well on the players, as what I've heard. They want it to be more interactive with fans. I mean, all this stuff, you just could kind of going into the great unknown. And I mean, it's exciting, isn't it? It's literally like an unprecedented, well, it feels like, I hate to use that word because it's ignorant, isn't it? But it feels, certainly feels like it's an unprecedented kind of move, or certainly one that's not happened for a number of years. I mean, when did Arnie, Jack break away and kind of form their sort of PGA Tour? It was back in the 60s and 70s, right? So this really does feel like a bit of a step change. And yeah, I think we're excited to go and sort of see how it plays out.
I do. If one thing on this worries slightly, and maybe this is just a traditionalist in me talking, but there's been a huge amount of stock put in the F1 documentary, what F1 are doing with the sport to make that more engaging to a, you know, I don't watch F1. I watch F1 documentary on Netflix. I'm into it for that reason only. There is a little bit that worries that maybe if this thing gets out of hand, that it takes the game further and further away from some of its core roots. Now, I'm not suggesting every single event should feel like the Walker Cup for any minute. You know, I'm not suggesting this should be, rolling the clock back 100 years, but you could quickly start to drift away from it. You know, when you talk about things like team colours, all that kind of stuff just feels like, Christ, this could be really jarring when you first see it, you know?
We've got quite far away from the game, yeah.
Yeah, do you know?
I
know we don't do a huge amount on the tour stuff.
We've been away from the Walker Cup for a long time. It's been so far away from the purest form of the amateur form of the game for decades. You know, like, this is just the next, I think, step along the way of it just increasing the gap between the ordinary golfer and the professional golfer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see. Any other news, gentlemen? And any other sort of parting thoughts? Live golf or otherwise?
Yeah, I'd just say no. Great to get this back together, you know, and chat it all through with you two. Feels like it's been a long time coming, and obviously a lot of juicy gossip on the professional side of things with Live to sink our teeth into. So,
we should do this more. We should do more of this. Perhaps that could be a New Year's resolution. We could just do more of this. Well, thank you very much for listening. I know that taking time out of your probably car journey is listening to us whitter along, as we do really appreciate it. And we will hopefully bring you something interesting live from the Live on Friday. So until then,
adios.
Watch this.